you a kind of backdrop of the High Tech Act of a year ago. So we'll review that at a very high level, just so you can see the context of the work that we're doing. And then I want to dive into the actual work that the Regional Extension Center will be doing with probably around 2,400 primary care practices around Washington and Idaho over the next 2 years. And we'll be talking a lot about the challenge of integrating technology into workflow. That is really the crux of this problem. It's not a matter of simply turning on technology and figuring out how to use it, but it's really how does information technology get integrated into our workflows in clinical practice, and is not a trivial problem to solve. So let's look at the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. There's a section in that called the High Tech Act, which is basically a whole bunch of money put into the healthcare system. Actually, the majority of it went to prop up Medicaid and COBRA payments that the states were quickly running out of as unemployment in 2009 was skyrocketing. But beyond those, which are the two largest, not the two largest, but the blue and the pink down at the bottom. But in addition to that, in green on this slide was somewhere in the neighborhood of $44 billion that was allocated to CMS to provide direct incentives to providers and hospitals for using electronic medical records. Then there were some other things. We're actually going to talk about the little yellow slice that says $2 billion there, which is money given to the Office of the National Coordinator to help primary care providers achieve meaningful use and qualify for this $44 billion. And then there's some other that I'm not going to talk about, grants through NIH and HRSA to community centers and things like that. The important thing about the $44 billion is you may read different numbers for the amount that was given to CMS to cover this incentive. There's a whole lot of sort of beltway magic involved in coming up with numbers for things like this, because as you will see as we dive into how it works, it depends on how many providers actually end up qualifying. And it is also built into some of the estimates of what the cost of this is going to be are the projected savings for providers actually using EHRs. So it gets real smoky fast, but this is our best estimate of the money that is actually earmarked to go out the door to provide incentives for providers. Now, it's broken into two segments. So providers may qualify for getting money through Medicare payments, or they can also do it through Medicaid. And as we will, because these are the two insurance products, of course, that CMS is responsible for. And you have to remember that the federal government, through these programs, is probably bearing at least 50% of the total healthcare costs in the country, because Medicare being people over 65 and that being the population that gets the highest healthcare costs very quickly, it turns into a major responsibility for CMS. Now, you'll see that the amounts of money in these two buckets is possibly the same, and really the target is much the same too. It's acute care hospitals and providers, and they've defined providers slightly differently, a little more liberal, if you will, for the Medicaid money that includes a number of mid-level practitioners, such as nurse practitioners and PAs, if they're working in either federally qualified health centers or rural, or if they actually run rural clinics. But it's very similar in terms of the amount of money and the requirements. To qualify for Medicaid, however, one has to be seeing at least 30% of their patient volumes paid for by Medicaid. And actually, not a lot of practices can do that unless they're specifically in the safety net group. So let's look real closely at what these incentive payments look like. And I'm going to first look at Medicare. And as you will see across the top, actually both sides is the years. I'd like to direct your attention to the column over on the right here, which shows the amount of money that will be going per to each provider who achieves meaningful use based on their Medicare payments. Now, the way this is calculated is you can actually get up to, you can get 75% of your total physician fees then added in addition to the regular fees you get, you can get a total of up to $44,000 per provider and it'll be $18,000 the first year if you start in 2011, and then it drops to $12,008, $12,004, and $12,002 if you start in 2011. And the way this is calculated is they give you 75% of your billing, and then it's capped out at this. So you basically have to be billing about $24,000 to get the 75% to come up to $18,000 for that first year. Now, if you notice though, if your start date is if it starts in 2011, then this is what you get over the course of the 5 years of the program. If you wait and start in 2012, you get exactly the same. It's just retarded by 1 year. If you wait till 2013, however, the first year drops by $3,000, and the fifth year falls off altogether. And then if you wait to start in 2014, the first year completely goes away. You start basically at the second year level, and so the total that a provider can get is $24,000 instead of $44,000. So there's a major incentive to get up and running on an EHR fast if you want to get the full incentive for this. The problem, of course, is that the timelines are very tight. If you're not already installing an EHR, it's going to be very difficult for a practice to start the process of choosing an EHR. It takes approximately a year to go through the whole selection process, practice evaluation, and make a good choice if you're doing your homework and doing all the proper preparation. And, of course, if you're not doing that preparation and you're just jumping into it, then the risk of failure is very high. So, and then, of course, the other thing to bear in mind is just getting the EHR turned on and installed is not meaningful use. There's a whole lot of work that has to happen after installation to really qualify for what the Office of the National Coordinator is defining as meaningful use, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. Now, that's the carrot. If you eat the carrot, or if you don't eat the carrot, it turns into a stick. And it turns into a stick pretty quickly, actually. In 2015, what there is for the providers who do not get up to meaningful use by 2015, what is in the works is a 1% reduction, which goes to 2% the following year and 3% the year after that, and there really is no limit set. So clearly CMS is turning up the screws. The impact that would have on primary care and specialty I've listed here, if depending on high and low, depending on how you define that, but this gives you sort of a ballpark figure of what the financial impact of those penalties might be. And it very quickly gets up into the amount that if you multiply it over, you know, 3 or 4 years of EHR use that you'd be paying for the EHR to go ahead and the penalty would be enough that you could have bought an EHR with that. Medicaid is a little different. You'll notice that it's not nearly as complex. Well, first of all, let's look at the right-hand column. It's half again as much money. So there's clearly a major emphasis for this to be spent to entice the safety net clinics, the ones that are actually seeing the Medicaid patients, to get them incented to get their meaningful use. What we see, though, is that the money spread out over 6 years instead of five. And there's the highest payment, of course, is again the first year, but then it stabilizes at $8,500 per year. And the only requirement for this, in addition to getting to meaningful use, is that you have to have 30% of your patient volume be Medicaid, unless it's pediatrics, and then the threshold is 20. And the other thing is, it continues all the way through 2021. You can start in 2016 and not bear any penalty at all. So it's a lot more lenient. On the other hand, not that many practices are seeing 30% Medicaid. So that's the idea. That's the big target at the end, and the big carrot, the enticement. It's very clear, though, that many, many practices are going to have a very difficult time getting up to what ONC is defining as meaningful use. And so with that in mind, there was also $2 billion in this High-Tech Act a year ago given to directly to the Office of the National Coordinator to come up with a program to help, to provide technical assistance and consulting to practices that they wanted, that they listed high priority. The observation, of course, is that it probably around 80% of Americans get their health care in small primary care offices, if they're getting primary care at all. And some of these are community clinics, some of these are rural clinics, and safety net clinics, but a lot of them are just small docs out in suburbia and in shopping malls and scattered across small towns. And so the idea is, how do we help those folks? We can't give them extra money to buy the EHRs, but we can give technical assistance and help them by providing that technical assistance to make good decisions and to stay on track and hopefully get up to the meaningful use and qualify for this incentive that's coming through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Now, the Office of the National Coordinator was actually given six things to do. The regional extension centers, at least from our perspective, is the centerpiece, but it's one of the more expensive ones. But there are five other programs. First of all, there's the state health information exchange cooperative agreement that every state had the opportunity to apply for. Washington State got about $12 million. This is being administered through the Office of the Healthcare Authority. And they are going to be setting up an infrastructure for the information exchange so that, since that's one of the criteria for meaningful use, and we can certainly get practices up to where they're prepared to exchange information, but if there's no infrastructure to do so, it's going to be pretty hard for them to qualify for meaningful use. So the states are quickly putting together infrastructures for this. There's also a workforce development a program that Bellevue College was awarded. I forget how much they were awarded, but they're responsible. They're one of five centers around the country that has put together a program that they will not only be training themselves, but will be mentoring other community colleges around the I think it's across Montana and into the Dakotas, in addition to Idaho. And I can't remember if they're doing Alaska, but they will be basically coming up with curriculum development for training people to be technology consultants in healthcare. And then there's the strategic, this one flunks the acronym test, for advanced research projects that went to a number of colleges around the country. The Beacon Community Projects were just announced today, actually. This is sort of breaking news. And INHS from Spokane was awarded, I think, $15 million as part of the Beacon Community Project. These were given to communities that had really made major advances in integrated healthcare solutions, including information exchange. And INHS, which is the Inland Northwest Health Services, has been doing this type of work for quite some time and is really a leader. So I'm not surprised that they were that they received this. And then there's a university training program as well that had 8 or 10 different universities, Harvard's among them. I forget all of them. So let's talk about the Regional Extension Center. That's kind of the backdrop to this. A lot of money being poured in by the Obama administration, both for to stimulate the economy, but to really try to get healthcare up into a state where we have the right technology to manage the amount of information that we're responsible for. So there are 60 regional extension centers. Every part of the country has one. They don't necessarily fall on state lines, obviously. Some are big, like Washington and Idaho, and Nevada and Utah are being run as a single regional extension center. On the other hand, California is broken into half a dozen. The state of Illinois has one for Cook County, Chicago, and a second one for the rest of rural Illinois. So there's a bit of a patchwork here, but Qualis Health, in administering this regional extension center for Washington and Idaho, is working with five technical assistance partners to be delivering the service, and we'll talk about what those services are in a moment. In fact, one of the partners is Inland Northwest Health Services, and it remains to be seen what impact they're getting the Beacon Communities Award will have on our working arrangement with them. But we're also working with Community Choice, which is a small technology group in central Washington based out of Wenatchee that works with a lot of migrant clinics and small rural clinics up and down the Central Valley there in the Okanagan. And then the PTSO is a technology company here in downtown Seattle that supports NextGen as an IT platform for a large number of community clinics and safety net clinics, not only in King County, but also in Yakima and some in eastern Washington and other parts of the state. And then we have several partners in Idaho, including the Idaho Health Data Exchange down in Boise, which is a health information exchange collaborative there, and then the North Idaho Health Network based in Coeur d'Alene in the area that Dave and I used to work when we were country docs. So the Regional Extension Center is going to has some targeted populations of providers. And as I mentioned, the emphasis here is on solo or small practices defined as fewer than 10 providers in one location. There's also an emphasis on public and critical access hospitals, primarily insofar as they have physician practices associated with those hospitals. The emphasis, remember that the hospitals can apply for the incentive, for the CMS incentive, as can these clinics. But this money that is going, the technical assistance to help them get there, is really targeted primarily at the providers in ambulatory clinic. Having said that, what this really is a federal subsidy for the technical assistance. We are also gearing up at Qualys, as are many of the regional extension centers, to provide consulting for specialty groups and hospitals anywhere at a fee. It just won't be subsidized by the Office of the National Coordinator. So what the technical assistance team that we're putting together very quickly, and we've hired about a dozen folks across the two states, and I just interviewed a very highly qualified person this morning, we're basically putting together a team of on-the-ground IT coaches whose job it will be to provide technical assistance, to work with project managers on site. So we won't be the project managers for these installations, but we will work with them basically to keep them on track. And this applies not only to groups that are starting the implementation process, but there are many, many places that have installed an EHR, but they skipped a whole lot of essential steps, and now they're struggling with it. It doesn't work for them very well. This is very common. So they've left out something, like the interface with a lab, maybe, or they're just not using physician order entry, and they don't understand how this very, very complicated piece of technology works, and then they're very frustrated because it doesn't work. So what we will end up doing is going through and making sure that the steps they've skipped are that they go back and fix that, and that they move forward in an orderly fashion. And I'll show you what that looks like in a moment. We're also going to be establishing learning communities. We've already been doing this actually over the past 5 years with some projects we've been doing with CMS, basically users groups where we identify practices that we're working with that are using the same IT platform. That one may be in Pocatello and another one might be over here in Western Washington, but they're dealing with the same problems. How do you report for diabetes out of your EHR, for example? Or how do you set your workflows up to give patients after visits summaries as they leave? And we can help them help each other by putting them together with either workflow experts or people from the vendor who can help them problem solve. So we're building these communities of practice, and then we're also doing peer-to-peer networking where we're building the relationships between different groups and allowing them to help them solve their own problems. These one-on-one consulting coaches do, and we have them in Pocatello and in Boise and in North Idaho, Eastern Washington, and up and down the I-5 corridor here. And we're really identifying three different stages of practice for these groups. So for example, there's the selection. You know, if a practice needs help selecting, then there's a very well-worked-out set of steps they need to go through. But if you've already got your EHR selected, you're not going to waste your time worrying about that. There may be some issues about contracting, how you set your contract up so that you don't find yourself all of a sudden discovering after implementation that you missed an opportunity to set things up in a way that now you regret not having done. Likewise, implementation is largely carried out by the vendors, but there's a whole lot that a practice needs to do to really get ready for implementation and to understand what it is that's being installed and how much work they really have to do with workflow evaluation and things like this. And then, of course, after implementation, the practice has gone live, there's a major emphasis on all the rest of the work. We're basically doing vendor-neutral EHR selection, although, you know, obviously there's a limit to how many EHR platforms you want out there, so we're helping put together some resources for group purchases. We can certainly help with upgrades and new feature rollouts for groups that already have their EHRs in place. The main thing we've been doing over the years is workflow consulting, we've had a tremendous amount of experience actually with privacy and security on a number of projects that we've done for the Office of the National Coordinator, and have been involved with some of the early efforts in health information exchange here in the state. So, allow me to put on my entrepreneur's hat for a moment and say, okay, this is all well and good, but what about the value proposition? How is this thing going to pay for itself? It's one thing, because actually, ONC is only going to subsidize this for the first 2 years, and then the money's basically going away. So the question is, what good is consulting? And if you had to charge practices for it, why would they purchase this service? And of course, this sort of breaks down into three logic arguments, as far as I can see. The first one is obvious: if you want to get the carrot, you have to get there. And if you think that you can simply turn on your EHR and get to meaningful use without some help in a short period of time, think again. It's not easy. And in fact, in the practice group I work in at UWPN, we've been running an EHR for 13 years, and that group is going to have a terrible time getting to meaningful use. Not because they don't have the technology, but because the biggest barriers really are change management and getting providers and their support staff to really understand how to use it properly so that they can do the things that are going to be required of them. The other thing is that when a practice does go live with an EHR, there's always a drop in productivity. A highly successful implementation still is going to probably result in a 25% drop in productivity. So you'll consider the implementation a success if it's a 25% drop in productivity that lasts no more than 3 months. So, you know, anything less that's worse than that can be a major hit economically. And so if you've got good guidance in going through this and can hit that minimum cost of implementation, there's a value there as well. The other thing we've discovered in talking to vendors is that there's a very clear value proposition for vendors to maybe subsidize the cost of participating in this regional extension center after the federal subsidy goes away by basically lowering the contract rate, because the vendor has a much lower cost if the user knows how to use their product properly and isn't struggling with it and calling them all the time and asking them to fix stuff that really isn't broken. It's just that they've got to go out and show them again how to use it. And then lastly, the work that we've been doing over the past 4 or 5 years in workflow redesign, it's very clear that a high percentage of the effort and the work that's done in primary care practices is really wasted because of inefficient workflows. And so much of what we do is really workflow redesign to optimize the workflow. And rather than have your workflows be then twisted to conform to the demands of the EHR, we actually have to take the EHR out of the picture for a moment, put the workflow together so it's optimal for people, and then look in the EHR for the tools to support that workflow. It's a very different way of thinking, but it's amazing how long practices get lost in that sort of EHR worship kind of approach to things. Now, if you listen to people in the Beltway, you somehow think that EHRs are the answer to controlling costs and improving quality. And the reality is they're not. There's a lot of studies that you're probably aware of that show that's just not true. On the other hand, EHRs do make lower costs and better quality possible. I mean, the way to think about this, of course, is that medicine is a very information-rich profession, and computers are really good tools for managing lots of information. So the goal here is integrating the technology into the workflow, and the strategy is very clearly get the right information to the right person at the right time so they can make the right decisions. And these are clinical decisions, but it's not just the clinicians who need the information. But how you set a workflow up to feed the information in, how you set the information system up to process the information so that it comes out so you can understand it and at the right moment, at the right person, that's the challenge. And every single one of these meaningful use elements has that exact challenge built into it. When you don't do it right, you get two unintended consequences of EHR implementation, and we see them all the time. First is, providers are just awash in the sea of poorly organized information. And secondly, they're spending a lot of their own time doing data entry and complaining about it because it doesn't make sense to them. And they're typing and entering things, and they think, it should be in there. It should do it for me. I'm struggling with this machine, and they fight it. So that's really the crux of this. How do we work? How do we get people who are pretty smart, actually, to work with computers? And the reality is that technology is a terrific tool, but it's a terrible master. You do not want the technology calling the shots here. And if you stop and think about it, both the EHR and and you compare that to the human mind, the information that we process as humans is very different than what EHRs need. We need it presented to us very different than the EHRs need, and it goes in we process it different, and we have different skills. So we need to be very clear about what those are before we start integrating this technology into our own workflow. So the idea is let the technology do what it does best, and let's encourage humans to do what they do best. So what does the technology do best? It's very good at keeping track of large amounts of data, particularly over long periods of time. It's also good at organizing data into patterns that it's programmed to recognize. So we can tell it what pattern to show. For example, if you have a creatinine that's going up on three different occasions and you've got a linear upward trend, it would be nice to be notified about that, even if all three of those are in the normal range. So you wouldn't necessarily see the pattern, but you can train the computer to watch for it and look back over time and alert you when that happens. They're very good at maintaining checklists, remembering complex rules and protocols, especially when there's lots of them. And so they can prompt us and become very useful for decision support. And the other thing is they don't get tired on Friday afternoons. People, on the other hand, if you stop and think about it, we have in our brains computers that are much, much more sophisticated and much more expensive, actually, than anything on our table or desk or in the box there. So what do we do best? And I think it's important to really think about this. One, we can make decisions and be accountable for them. We're very good at recognizing patterns where there wasn't one recognized before. We're really good at sorting out through the noise and finding the signal. And it's almost like we naturally look for patterns in chaos. And what this we do this by assessing the relative importance of information and then using our intuition to kind of figure out what's really going on. And we're good then, what we're excellent at is putting this information into the context of the patient. And we do this by things like assessing the emotional valence of the information. You know, well, you got a hangnail, and you got a lump in your breast, and you got a... No, these are two different types of things, and you deliver the information, you work with people a very different way. Computers don't do that. We also can assess the quality of life, and of course we establish and maintain relationships with people over long periods of time. So it's fitting these two together, and what we have to do at every stage is to make sure that the inputs to the computers are perfect for the computer, and the inputs for the people are perfect for the for the people. So we can't ask the technology to do things that it can't do. And then in addition to this, so each workflow has information that needs to be fed in a certain way, just like you have to put your cash card into the cash machine exactly the right way or it's not going to read it. Well, we have to put vital signs in exactly the right way if we want all the rules engines to work and give us a flow sheet that we can actually use. But there's also information that's already been processed by the human mind that is destined for the human. It's not going to be processed by the computer at all. It's the narrative. Here's the doctor who's already listened to the patient, who's thinking about has decided he or she understands what's going on and is able to put that into words, that's immensely valuable to the next reader. And if you run it through a computer by a whole bunch of yes-no buttons that then constructs an English sentence to try to present that to a human, you've downgraded the quality of the information and completely ruled out, you've wiped out the value of all the work that human brain did to assemble the information that way. So there's lots of different things going on. Now, this is a list of the meaningful use elements. And I want to point out a couple of things. First, nowhere on this list is physician progress notes. So it's just not there. This is all about little rules engines, information being fed in categorical or numerical formats into specific fields, and being then processed and then being spit out as some sort of an output that might be it might be a transition of care document, it might be a med list, it might be an alert that tells you that you just tried to prescribe something that the patient that the computer knows the patient's allergic to, or the drug-drug interaction. So this is not about progress notes. And it's really easy for physicians to get distracted by the progress notes, which, as I mentioned, are really important, but we have to keep these straight. The second thing I want to point out is that the ones that I've colored in green are already available, and they're being used. I mean, I use them every day. The group health, you know, and any big delivery system that has an EHR is using all of this stuff in green. They may not be using them well enough to qualify for meaningful use, or you may have implemented, there may be EHR implementations that have missed a bunch of these, and there are some very expensive workarounds that are going on. But there's no new technology development that has to happen. The orange ones, on the other hand, really are kind of work in progress. So when they put those five things up there, they really were putting a stretch limit out there, which is going to be a challenge for a couple of reasons. First of all, for these ones that aren't available, the pipeline for new features in an EHR is measured in years. So and even if they come out tomorrow with an upgrade that has all these things, syndromic surveillance, the EHR transition document or interoperability, you don't necessarily want to be the first place to test out a new upgrade, having been through that experience. And it took a year to recover. There's always bugs in new versions. And so most places wait at least a year for the vendor to get the bugs out of the new upgrades and the new versions. The other thing to remember, and why this is going to be a real challenge for small practices, is that the big systems like the UW or Swedish or Group Health have big IT shops to go with it, and they've been doing this stuff for years. So, and they're still struggling with the workflow side of it. But these folks are going to have a real hard time in the small practices, because they're going to be expected to repeat that feat, but in less than 2 years. And again, as I say, the biggest challenge, whether you're large or small as a delivery system, is just the tolerance for change in your delivery system. So it's a huge step. What we found it very useful to do in thinking about meaningful use, that list I showed you wasn't organized very well. I mean, I can't quite think of it very clearly the way it's listed there, and it looks like just a huge wall of tasks to do. So what we've tried to do is let's come up with a different way of thinking about this. If we organize this into smaller steps, or at least into groups of smaller steps, so we group them together into six steps is what we basically did. And then we were looking for a metaphor to really kind of show this. You know, there's lots of metaphors for building something, like building a house, but that doesn't do it very well. You know, you sign the contract and you move out and they pay the guy and then you move back in and you click the switch and lights all turn on. This is different. This is a high-risk venture going where people don't go very often. And it occurred to me this is a lot more like a mountaineering expedition. You've got to have the right people, I mean a big one, you know, not just necessarily climbing Mount Si, but a real serious mountaineering expedition. You want to make sure you got the right team, the right equipment. Everybody has to know how to use it. And there's a whole lot of unknowns that are going to happen. And the other thing is that each part of the climb is different. So with that in mind, I put together this slide. This is the south approach to Mount Everest, for those of you who haven't thought about Mount Everest before. And what I did is we broke these, the 25 steps or elements of meaningful use are broken into segments. And the way that we broke this up takes into account the fact that if you don't do something down below and you start out up leaving something undone, it's kind of like not checking to make sure your oxygen tanks and the regulators work. You're going to come off the mountain before you get to the top. And you could get in serious trouble. So just to talk you through this, getting to base camp here, just starting out, you can actually click off four of these meaningful use elements with nothing but your practice management system. In other words, the billing system. You can get all your demographic pieces working. You can go through the entire drill of privacy and security to make sure that everybody is, you know, using this in a way that's secure. And you can start to do this electronic checking of insurance eligibility and submitting your claims electronically. And you haven't touched the delivery system at all. You haven't messed with them. The next step, which I call going through the Kumba ice fall up to Camp 1, is turning on your interfaces. Now, this is a step that often gets missed. When the vendors come in, they want to turn on the charting because the docs really like seeing their own notes on the, you know, in the computer. But if you don't do this, and we've seen a lot of groups over in Eastern Washington and North Idaho that skip this step, now you get further on and you try to get your information back from the lab and you got pieces of paper. And what are you going to do with that? Is somebody going to enter it? Is somebody going to scan it? How are you going to use that? So we make sure that before you start out for Camp 2, you've really done everything you need to do, because the climb to Camp 2 is much, much, this is where the delivery system gets heavily impacted. So you're turning on computerized order entry, you're doing e-prescribing, you're doing your medication lists and your allergy lists, and you're doing your vital signs, you're making sure you've got your problem list. This is where people are putting information into the computer so the computer can actually use it. And there's a whole lot of workflow redesign that has to go with that. The next camp, you couldn't have gotten to Camp 3 unless you'd done everything on the list in Camp 2, because now we're going to turn on the data use tools. These are the rules engines that start to process the information that you put in and feed it back to you in a format that you can do something with. So the decision support tools that might tell you that your diabetic patient is overdue for something, or this is a patient that as long as they're here, you might want to think of getting a mammogram and a colonoscopy ordered. Or running a list of give me the names of all my people with diabetes or asthma. And this is also where you can format this information into where you can hand something to the patient. Say, here's the orders we did. Here's your meds now. We cleaned up your med list. Here's the things you're still overdue for. And then we get up into the very high country here of begin to data share. This is where you upload to child profile. You're starting to report to CMS. And things like this. And then the summit, of course, is this kind of holy grail of information exchange. So this is a format that, now what's nice about this is you have to take things in steps and you have to respect the stage you're at, and if you get ahead of yourself, you're going to get in trouble. So really what we think of what we're doing here in the Regional Extension Center is we're providing a guide service. So we're making sure you got the right equipment in your packs for the next stage of the climb, that you're not getting off route, that you're paying attention, that you're working together properly, and of course we do crevasse rescue as well. So this is really a couple of interesting things. You can burn out a metaphor fairly quickly, and I don't want to overdo it here. And for example, one difference between a group of climbers on Mount Everest and what a small practice is doing is everybody on the mountain really is obsessed with getting to the summit. And if you have a practice full of docs, you got people that would just assume that we weren't doing this. And that would make it very, very different if you were trying to climb Mount Everest. But there is one thing that's interesting that I came across in looking for the right photo for this slide. That is, does anybody know what the mortality rate for climbing Mount Everest is? If you look over the past 20 years, it's 10%. A little better than Russian roulette, but it's a high-risk game to climb this mountain. What's interesting, though, is that if you look at the past 5 years, the mortality rate is only 4.7% or something like that. What's the difference? That's a significant drop. It's not that they have better boots or better, oxygen or something. It's that now it's possible, using current technology, to get real-time information on weather from hour to hour to people up on the mountain. In other words, so that they can make the right decision. So now we can get the right information to the right people at the right time so they can make the right decision. And that has improved outcomes dramatically. And I think that's about as good a metaphor as we can do for where we're trying to get to with information systems in healthcare. I'm conscious of the time. I'm going to stop there and see if anybody has any questions. In back.
Yeah, thanks. It was a great presentation. Some of us here also do workflow analysis and study the changes that need to take place to successfully implement the information system into a new environment. Since you mentioned that you do workflow consulting, I would be really interested to hear how you guys reconcile the changes that you need to make in the practice that you're working with when you're implementing a new information system, and how you balance sort of retrofitting the system to match the workflow versus changing the workflow so that the information system will be the most useful.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the puzzle that has to be solved. And what we've seen, of course, is that the EHR vendors went in and looked at the current workflows and then built tools to fit the current workflows, what they thought would work and what their medical consultants told them would work, which was sometimes right, but it wasn't necessarily spreadable. And as we know, a lot of these workflows then have a lot of unnecessary steps in them. So what we do, we actually, our technique for doing this consulting basically is to go in and work with the practice themselves. We pick a team of 8 to 10 people, and we have a representative of every role that touches that workflow. And we go through it's sort of a modification of lean reengineering design, where we teach people the principles of understanding the different categories of waste, and we do some simulations. It's about a 6-hour workshop that we do. Then what we have them do is we have them map out their current workflow in painful detail. And what's interesting about that is there's no one person that understands the workflows. Invariably, these workflows go from the front desk to the back office staff, to the provider, maybe to the lab or the referral coordinator, and then back to the front desk. And the patient's involved. And so what we do is we map these out, and everybody is sort of stunned by how complicated it is, and we point out the areas that there's a lot of variation. And that seems to be the biggest area of waste, is a lot of people are doing it different, and they don't have any idea what the other folks in the same workflow are doing. Then what we do is we have them redesign it themselves. We don't think that we are in the best position, and we certainly don't think that even their own leadership is in the right position to say, here's the new way of doing it, we found a better way, and so on. Yeah. If you're the person on the front lines doing the workflow, you hear that all the time. We actually have the people doing it build their new workflow and to map it out. Now we give them ideas, and we constantly remind them of sort of principles of avoiding different kinds of waste. And they don't necessarily come out with fewer steps, but what they do, we always have an IT person in the room. And what we try to do then is make sure that that first of all, the workflow makes sense and it's far less error prone, and it's stabilized in terms of not having the variation, so everybody understands. For example, we did one up here at Hall Health with medications, and discovered that there were 3 different screens in Epicare that you could go in, that the MA could go in and look at the meds to review with the patient. But each of them had different functionalities, so we had to pick one and say, this is the Hall Health way of doing it. And then, and so every workflow has like it's the thing, the part it's wrestling with it that's not doing very well. Then what we do is we come up with a future state that they're happy with. And then we test it out on a very small scale. And we tweak it a little bit, and we find some metrics to make sure that the changes, the improvement. So we've really sort of integrated the IHI rapid improvement cycle methodology with as much of the lean sort of philosophy and waste nomenclature and single piece flow as we can, and then without confounding it with a whole bunch of Japanese words so that people feel like it's a cult, because it's not. It's just common sense. And that's really the process that we use. It's been very successful. We've done this in 30 or 40 practices on, you know, dozens of different workflows. And it's actually been very, very interesting. Yeah?
I noticed that you listed dentists in your list of practitioners in your early slide. Mm-hmm. To what extent have Paulus and your activity as a wire dealt with the cross-disciplinary integration of information flow in the sense that the national effort has recognized that that's what they want to do, but they haven't really...
Yeah, we've done information exchange work. I was actually on a project with Dave that the state put together to really look at different approaches to health information exchange that involved actually giving the information to patients in an electronic format that they could use in a health record bank that's being piloted in four different places around the state. Five different places around the state. So that's an example. This particular project that we're doing at the Regional Extension Center is pretty much focused on primary care. The list you're referring to is what CMS will reimburse providers for, which providers will CMS reimburse. In other words, where are the incentives? And certainly dentists are one of those. Mental health was just included a couple of weeks ago as well. But that is the challenge, and it's not just across disciplines, but it's even the question really comes down to who are the natural trading partners of adult delivery system for information, and they're going to tend to be close to home, across the street groups, and it will be and it clearly is multidisciplinary as well.
The issue is enterprise view and life cycle principles in terms of getting the conceptual content so that the cross disciplines can appreciate the commonality, the common conventions for information that they have in common. Now the different disciplines have different conventions many times, and that causes a lot of confusion. I'm just curious the extent to which you're addressing that with the various specialty societies that you're working with.
Yeah, this is our program is really geared towards getting people up to a level that's somewhat below what you're talking about. Are there any other questions? I think we were going to end it at 10 till, as I recall. Is that correct?
If not, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sign up sheet for those registered students is down here. If you missed it, make sure to get your name in, and we will see you all next week.